All right, it's Liam. I want to thank everyone at the Oasis Podcast, as you were.
Hello and welcome back to the Oasis Podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. I hope you guys are all right. I've got a really good episode today, a fantastic interview, if I do say so myself, with Adam Nutter, a guitarist from The Music and a solo artist to be, as he's very, very shortly going to be releasing his solo album. And he's got a live show coming up, so check the link in the description for all the information about that. And yeah, and I hope you guys enjoyed this. It's a really fun one. It's just so great to hear someone who's so honest and just wants to sort of give his opinion and isn't mincing his words. And it's just fantastic. And yeah, really real honor to speak to him. Plus, I know he's also done an interview with Katie as well for sound effects. And so, yeah, obviously I sort of tend to just scratch the surface and talk about music, but you know how good Katie is. I'm sure that is going to be even more fascinating, so I'll make sure to let you know about that when that drops as well. But anyway, so that's coming up. First off, the only thing to really talk about, there's been no other real news in the Oasis world other than Ryan Adams has now released the full kind of Oasis covers album, The Morning Glory. It's called Morning Glory, so it's basically the Morning Glory album and a couple of the B-sides from the time as well. And I've listened to it, and I've got to say, like, I really appreciate it, and I can see it's good. Really well done, well put together, interesting melodies. I like the way he's sort of arranged it and stuff. It's impressive work. And it's nice to see someone doing something different with Oasis, because we've talked about covers on here in the past. When people cover Oasis, it tends to be very straightforward, and it's just not as interesting. Whereas he does change the melodies here, he messes around with them, but it just annoys me, to be honest. Like, I'm hearing him change these melodies, and I'm just thinking, nah, sing it properly, you're kind of getting it wrong. And then when he does sing it properly, you think, oh, that sounds much better. You know, the reason that Noel wrote those melodies in the first place is that's the best melody to be played over that, to be sung over that chord sequence. So when he kind of messes with it, it just doesn't sound as good. So yeah, so fine for what it is. I've had it on like in the background a few times and generally have enjoyed it, but I do find they get a bit samey. They're all kind of along that sort of similar style to his Wonderwall cover, and yeah, and they're fine for what they are. But I mean, for instance, like Head Shrinker, he's done, and I was thinking, oh, maybe for Head Shrinker he'll do that as an out and out punk, you know, and he doesn't. It's just in the same sort of style, and that really doesn't suit Head Shrinker. But one of the things I do like is that, you know, he's shining a light on some of these tracks and some of the lesser known album tracks and things that he's done, or other B-sides like Rocking Chair, that, you know, that he does a really good job. And it is really great to demonstrate how great these songs are and how fantastic the melodies are. So, yeah, so I appreciate it for what it is. Is it going to be, you know, regular rotation for me? No, it's not. But you know, I'm pleased it's out there, and and I hope you guys are enjoying it if that's the sort of thing that you like. Finally, just to say, there is a lot of controversy around Ryan Adams from you know, from the way he's been the way he's treated women over the years, which I know is pretty dreadful by the sounds of it. So I know a lot of people are just not going to listen to it. And I had a few people say, "Oh, are you going to cover it?" I'm like, "Well, yeah, I should really cover it, I suppose, because it's important. It's a very big, famous artist doing a cover version, an album of Oasis covers." So yeah, it's definitely worth commenting on, I think. So if you don't want to listen to it, that's entirely up to you. That's all I have to say about that. So I hope you guys enjoy that. One other thing to say is over on YouTube, I've just uploaded a first of what I'm planning to be a new series of sort of the documentaries, like little mini documentaries on the Britpop history side. And what I'm looking to do is just do reviews of pretty much every Britpop album ever made. I did polls over on Twitter a while back, just with every Britpop album and just getting you guys to rate them. And yeah, and so I've managed to collate all that now. So I think I've got 121 albums all rated. And so I thought, well, how should I do this? Let's just review them all. And because I'm sort of enjoying messing around on YouTube a bit. So yeah, I'm going to put those out on YouTube primarily, I think. I might put them out on the main podcast channel as well, but YouTube is going to be the main place for those. So yeah, I'll put a link in there in the description to that. So I hope you guys enjoy that. All right, and that'll do it. Here is my interview with Adam Nutter. Well, welcome to the Oasis podcast. Adam Nutter, how you doing, man?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
No, all good. I love it when these things come together so quickly. Some people, especially artists, you know, who are far less successful than yourself, it's like, oh, you go through my management and you have to go through this person and jump through hoops and give prepared questions. You replied to a tweet of mine on Twitter. I dropped you a message. You're like, yeah, do you want to speak Tuesday? Brilliant. It's great, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, mate. Yeah, no, I'm not like that at all. Do you know what I mean? I've got no airs and graces or anything that makes me think I'm more important than anyone else. So no, not at all, man. Do you know what I mean? You reached out, and I'm more than happy to come on people's podcasts and have a chat. Any excuse to talk about stuff that I love as well. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. That's my favorite thing about this. And what one of the things I really love about your podcast, and if people don't know, Adam's got a fantastic podcast, and is that, you know, it is that passion and it's that love of music. And it's that, you know, what I've just your last episode you did where you were talking about recording those early demos and that first time in a studio and all that sort of stuff. So many musicians you interview, it's like, oh, how was that? Oh, yeah, it was great. You know, and it's like, okay. Can you expand on that a little bit? whereas what I loved about yours is, you know, you really, when you tell the stories, you're really in the story. You're getting all the, you know, you can almost smell the weed smoke. Let me put it that way.
That's what it's about, really. Do you know what I mean? Sort of connecting people. And it, what it's about for me is just sort of sharing that love of music in general and of the music and stuff, because that was one of the greatest things that has come out of all, you know, since I joined Twitter and since the listening parties and then consequently since the gigs and stuff. The biggest thing that I loved was when the band split up and we kind of disappeared, it was like all the memories of it disappeared as well. Everything sort of disappeared. So suddenly to be brought into an environment where there's lots of people who loved my band, do you know what I mean, who loved the music and have got such fond memories, and it's almost like I'm just kind of one of them, really, but more like a mouthpiece for memories and nostalgia and all those sorts of things. And I love talking about the music and my experiences in it, and I think as well, I think it might be different for people who, because obviously we kind of had a career and then we've disappeared and all sort of forged normal lives. And I think that's taught me a lot about, well, a lot about bullshit, if you will. Do you know what I mean? Like to appreciate everything, see things through different eyes and not carry any ego because of it. Do you know what I mean? I think that's something that I find quite important, but also quite abhorrent about other artists who do have, look, I understand private people and people who might have a little bit of a fuck off and leave me alone attitude, you know what I mean? But like that's I just love sharing my passion and sharing a window into what we went through. Because I do think there's a common misconception from a lot of people that, oh, well, you're in a band, so every minute of every day is absolutely amazing, which, you know, as I've detailed in my podcast episode, some of them, it's not always the case. Do you know what I mean? It's a difficult industry and environment to be in at any age, let alone as young as we were. And we were very lucky in that we had fantastic protection from the management structure we had, who all understood that, look, these are young kids. And I often liken it to footballers, do you know what I mean? Especially if you get picked up by an academy at seven or six, sometimes five, six, seven, 8 years old, and you're in that academy all the way through till 16, 17, and then suddenly you're dropped. And it's like, well, hang on, I've been building my life with the view that I'm going to be a professional footballer, and now I'm not. There's nothing here to hold me up. Do you know what I mean? Which was something that was, it's very similar in music. Do you know what I mean? When you're hot as a band or an artist, you've got teams and swathes of people who are supporting you and making sure that everything goes right. And then when that all goes, it's, you know, I find that sort of thing fascinating. You know, there's quite a few podcasts, When the Lights Go Out, I think, which is based on sports personalities who've come out of high profile sports. And then I think that's boxing. And then you've got to try and forge a new life. But I realize that was a very long answer to the question, but anyway.
No, absolutely. It's brilliant. And the, I think the funny thing, so just to give you a heads up, I was born 1980. And so when the music came through, I think I was at uni, and you were sort of, it was such an exciting band, having been a massive Britpop fan, and then that having sort of gone away a bit. And we had this sort of quiet couple of years with like Travis and Stereophonics. And then you guys came out and it was like, who the fuck are these boys? You know, and also I think you were pretty much the first band that was younger than me that came through, and like I was just like, this is mad. And I remember those first videos of Rob's hair being so big, and just the sound of it. I'm like, you know, and I'd loved, you know, the Prodigy, and I'd loved I'd loved dance music, and I'd loved obviously rock and roll, and I'd loved the Stone Roses. And then it's like these boys have, and at the time you had Primal Scream, had done Exterminator. And, you know, and so that sort of fusion of dance and rock and like the Led Zeppelin-y, it was just like, this is the, who the fuck are these boys? This is, they're from another planet. You know, so that was just so exciting when you guys burst in the scene. But man, like you said, you guys were so young. You know, that was the first time that, you know, I remember you in interviews and stuff. It's like, Christ, these boys are like 17. You know, this is just madness. I mean, how was that being, as like you said, being thrust into the scene of it so young? And did you think at the time what we've got is special and is different to what's out there?
Well, I think very much so. I mean, the band kind of formed along a process, but one of those processes was me and Rob used to go for like walks around the village. We'd walk up to Takeaway and get chicken kebabs and just walk about and just talk about like what we wanted to do with this band that we were starting and putting together. And you know, one of the things that sticks in my memory was a conversation we had like about the Stereophonics at the time. And do you know what I mean? Literally walking down a ginnel next to a community center. I remember turning to him and just going like, "We, do you know what I mean? I know it's different, but like we shit on these. Do you know what I mean? In terms of like the power we've got, and the power you've got, and like the music we make, like this shit's all over the radio and people are loving it. Like we're better than this."
Mm.
You know what I mean? We're better than this. And then another interesting point you made there about Exterminator. That was a record, quite an influential record on me at the time. I remember listening to Exterminator and just thinking, yeah, man, this is, do you know what I mean? Just something that was a little bit different. Cause I loved Primal Scream before, but that record in itself, it's quite a unique album. And that was like a bit of fuel to my creative fire at that time. I think, don't know whether it was more sort of legitimizing our own ideas of, you know, you don't just have to do straight A, B, A, B, C, A, B songs. Do you know what I mean? That sort of more formulaic, I suppose, because, you know, we were doing things like 7-8 minute instrumentals and stuff like that. And we didn't see that as any different to a 4 minutes of Take the Long Road. Do you know what I mean? It, sure. Everything sort of had its place in that regard. But yeah, we were ridiculously young, and I think that with our experience, I think that's one thing that I'm quite equipped to do, and I've done it a couple of times. Really, is I've had people approach me and say, "Oh, my son's in a band, and they've been approached by these people and these people and all this stuff," and you're very much like, "Well, just slow down." Do you know what I mean? Just slow down and think about the welfare, the mental well-being of all the children involved. And you need to manage expectations. You need to be clear about possibilities and things like that, because very difficult dangling a carrot like that in front of a young mind and expecting them to be able to deal with it, really. And I think our management probably on reflection would... there's probably things that they would have probably done differently, I would imagine. But hindsight's a beautiful thing for everyone, isn't it? But we were incredibly young, which I think took a lot of people by surprise. You know, a lot of people say, "Well, your music's so far beyond your years and all that sort of stuff." Which I don't know. We were like in a bubble, so that sort of stuff just like it didn't really mean anything to us. Do you know what I mean? It's like, "Oh, your music's so far beyond your years." It's like, "Well, we did it in practice room last week, so I don't know what you want me to say. Are we not allowed to make music this expansive because we're young?" Do you know what I mean? It's just the sum of our individual parts just brought together the opportunity to create this unique sound, because all of us were disenfranchised in some ways. And I think one of the biggest things was, and it's probably quite cliche really, but being from like, you know, a little mining village where what young people do is drink on street corners and knock about causing issues and shit like that. That just want us. Do you know what I mean? Like, we'd much rather have been on our instruments, because that's what I thrive. So when I started playing guitar and got an effects board and started writing riffs and creating sounds and that, it was just like, right, my thing in life is coming up with a cool riff or a cool sound or a cool riff with a cool sound, and walking into the practice room and being like, "Right, lads, listen to this. Do you know what I mean? I'm going to start playing this and you lads are going to fucking start doing what you do. And in 10 minutes, we're going to have the germ of something absolutely amazing. That in itself was like a drug. You know, that was better than on some street corner, bloody smoking a joint or drinking alcohol or something like that. There's nothing that can replace that buzz for me, because you're pulling something from nothing. Do you know what I mean? Mm. You're creating something from nothing that other people look at or listen to and just be like, shit, man, that means something to me. And like, how did you do that? And it's like, well, I don't bloody know. Do you know what I mean? we didn't set out to make music that meant something to people. All we set out to do was not even try and make something of ourselves, really. Just try and do. I mean, I know people say life's short, but at the end of the day, there's a lot of time you've got to fill in life. You know what I mean? And I think we were just looking for something to fill our time that was engaging and that made us feel good about something and that made us feel part of something. Certainly that's something that was very big for me, was feeling part of something. And like when the band ended, that's something I struggled with massively, that void of, as I say, feeling part of something.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. One thing I was going to say, when you said about, you know, coming from the little mining village and stuff. Well, I was talking, we sort of, the recent episode, we were talking through our sort of favourite songs from the noughties. We were talking about Arctic Monkeys. And I remembered that when they first came out, there was sort of a lot of anti kind of northern bias from the music press. And even to the point where people were questioning they had help from their music teacher or something, because kids that young couldn't have come up with something that good. Like, you know, the line about Montagues and Capulets, it's like, and there was a sneering kind of snobbishness against them. And obviously Oasis had that, you know, that was in droves back in the 90s. But did you find that coming through? Was there, I mean, the fact you were so young and also, you know, coming from the north, did you sort of have to deal with that much?
Yes.
Okay, thanks very much.
yes is the short answer to that. I mean, it's a good question, is that, and it's probably quite a long response that's required, but I'll try and be concise. Our representation or treatment in the press, I found extremely schizophrenic, in the sense that even within the same outlets, and The Enemy is a perfect example, really, in that one minute we were, you know, this young, exciting band making this these great sounds, and then the next minute we're trog-faced wankers, I think was the quote from Mark Beaumont, whoever the fuck he is. Do you know what I mean? And The Enemy is a case in point, really, in it, because all you had with The Enemy was like a conveyor belt of pricks looking to make themselves sound important via the use of hyperbole and all sorts of language bollocks, where it wouldn't really matter what they were reviewing or writing an article about. The primary function they had was trying to make themselves look clever, often at other people's expense, which I think is something that in today's society is much less tolerated. Do you know what I mean? And we were often this sort of thought of as just scruffy stoner northern lads and treated as such, but as I say, schizophrenic, because at the same time with The Enemy, you'd suddenly have like an article that was, you know, full of positivity about the band. I mean, the thing with that sort of shit is it's the luck of the draw. Do you know what I mean? It's like The Enemy or any outlet is made up of 10 people, so for example, and 8 of them don't like you and 2 of them do. You have to drop on the luck of getting the 2 that do that write the articles. And it's an incredibly political, mad world, all that shit. You know, like our second album, I think they gave it a 2 out of 10. And our management basically rang up the editor and were just like, fuck you, this is unacceptable. You know, we're not having this. And he went, oh, it's all right, I like the music, I'll scratch that and I'll write it myself. And it got a 9 out of 10. Do you know what I mean? Like,
I'm kidding. That's ridiculous, isn't it?
But that's how it works. That's how it all works. Do you know, it's all mates and, you know, backslapping and political stuff. Do you know what I mean? And that's a fine example of it, where you can ring someone up and be like, I'm not having that. You're not giving my band that. And them going, oh, all right, yeah, we'll put someone on it who actually likes it. But no, I personally struggled massively with how we were represented for various reasons. And another hilarious one to me is, I mean, I fucking hate hypocrisy, me. I'm like an hypocrisy spotlight, and I'll just shine it in anyone's face. And, you know, like, the music was made up of us four, and it was very much all four of us. Yeah. It wasn't like... Well, I'm trying to think of an example now, but, you know, a lot of the time it's all about the front man. Do you know what I mean? And it's
Louise Weller and the Sleeper Blokes.
Yeah, but we were very much like four equal parts, and it was silly. Well, maybe people say it was silly things, but, you know, they'd be like, oh, well, we only want Rob on the front cover, and you're like, well, all right, but it's all four of us, and they're like, well, no, we only ever put the singer on the front cover, and then I'm like, well, how come all fucking seven members at Coral were on fucking front cover 2 weeks ago then? You know what I mean? What are you talking about? Be real, motherfucker. Don't feed me straight lines and lie to me, because I'll just shut you down like that. How come you've got all the Coral on the front cover, yet when it comes to us, oh no, it's just Rob. You know, if you think us lot look like fucking chav scrubbers or something, fair enough, turn round and say, we don't want you on front cover, you look like shit. At least then I'll have a giggle to myself. But turning round and saying, oh, no, we only ever have the band on the front cover. It's like, I've got a memory, mate, and you put shit in print, so don't expect me not to find it. But you have no power. As an artist in that situation, you have no power. All you can do is appeal to your press officer. I mean, usually you don't have to. It's usually your press officer who will liaise with these people behind the scenes and be like, look, you know, this isn't acceptable. But a lot of the time, outlets like that choose who they're going to support and who they're not going to support. But to answer your question, came across a lot of, oh, they're just scruffy northern lads. But not from everywhere, you know, like, we got a lot of love from things like Q Magazine and Kerrang, do you know what I mean? Outlets like that that were sort of less obsessed with trying to claim that they are the creators of scenes and movements. And there was a horrible Catch 22 back in the day where the NME did have a lot of power. I've no idea about it now, but certainly back in the day when it was properly in print, they did have a lot of power, and they had the ability to make or break bands. Do you know what I mean? And like, I don't give a shit, to be honest. And I don't think any of us ever did. We were never the type of people who'd be like, oh, well, we better do what they say if they can sell us three extra records. Do you know what I mean? It's like, fuck you. I can't give a shit. Do you know what I mean? I ain't laying down just because you think you're fucking really important, especially when I've just read you call me a trog-faced fucking wanker. Do you know what I mean? I'm a fucking 18-year-old kid. You're a bloody 40-year-old bloke or something, and you're calling me a trog-faced wanker. Let's see you say that to me fucking face. And you see, that's my problem in a nutshell. You know what I mean? I'm not like some passive-aggressive person that's just going to sit and
play the
that.
Game.
I'm fucking aggressive, mate. Do you know what I mean? I'm the most respectful, loveliest person in the world, unless you don't show it to me, and then I'll give you the other side of it back tenfold, because I just can't do with injustice. And I don't know, we had things like, you know, they wanted to dress Robin Angel Wings and all this sort of shit, and I always had a real strong idea of how I wanted the band to be represented, and it's dealing with that realization that I can't fully control that. You have to, and I remember walking in and Rob were dressed in this bloody angel outfit with a halo and wings and they were all taking pictures. And I just walked in and just went, what the fuck is this? Do you know what I mean? It's like, well, we agreed to it. I'm like, no, we fucking didn't. We said, can we not do all this angel wing crap, please? But you've just gone ahead and done it anyway. So whatever. Do you know what I mean? It's primarily in this country where, as I say, I think there's a lot of snobbery. I don't think the snobbery is necessarily aimed at northern bands, although I'm fully willing to accept that it is. I think the snobbery was more based in we're bigger than the bands that we are talking about.
Got you.
And, you know, like when you learn about these brokering meetings that happen where your manager or, you know, the guy who sits behind your managers, the real head of the scene, will ring up the editor of the Enemy and go, I want a fucking meeting with you, mate. Come on, let's go have a conversation. And they'll sit down and go, oh, why are you fucking slagging my band off all the time? And then going, oh, well, I don't want to upset this guy because he also represents that band. So we'll start talking good about him. Do you know what I mean? It's bollocks.
That's
it's
like unbelievable, isn't it?
That's ridiculous. But that's how it works. And then you've got all these people who are consuming this media, not privy to how all that bullshit works. It's like radio in America. You think you get on radio in America because you're good? Do you fuck? You get on radio in America because someone's given someone a backhander or licked someone's ass or bought someone an expensive fucking meal at Nobu. Do you know what I mean? That's how it works. And it's the same with support bands and all this crap and people like, well, you should have them as support band. Support bands work like anything else. Mm. You know, someone's manager knows someone else who knows your manager, who rings your manager and goes, all right, mate, yeah, we used to knock about back in debt. I'm representing this band now. Fancy giving us a leg up. And then your manager comes to you going like, this band, they want to do it. What do you think? And don't get me wrong, some bands are very... have a very hands-on role in terms of support acts and request support acts. That does happen, don't get me wrong. But the majority of the time, it's just backhanders and political favours. And, well, you did that for me 10 years ago with that band. So, yeah, your band can support my new up-and-coming band. That's fine. Do you know what I mean? It's a mad sort of very... I can't think of the word, really, but... But I think the salient point is one, and I think it's something that's again more highlighted nowadays, but is the mental impact reading shit like that has on young people. Do you know what I mean? If you're a footballer and you're 25, 26 and you're reading shit about you in the press that you don't like, it's not going to be nice, but at least you've got years under your belt to be like, right, okay, do you know what I mean? I can process that. When you're an 18-year-old kid, especially someone like me with undiagnosed ADHD and bipolar, and there's people calling you trog-faced wankers and shit like that, and you're like, well, hang on, what's that got to do with my fucking music? Mm. What's that got to do when 1,000 people turn up in room and go absolutely fucking mental? Just because you think I'm a wanker because I'm from a fucking... A mining village in North and not from fucking, I don't know, Camden Town or some shit. Do you know what I mean? You think you've got the right to just talk about us like we're, well, you know, no. Fancy being called a trog-faced wanker by a 40-year-old bloke when you're fucking 18 and you've never even met the lad. Do you know what I mean? It's like, fuck you, mate. Honestly, man. Fucking hell.
Oh, dear. It's madness. The one you mentioned about support bands there, and one thing I definitely wanted to just talk to you about is that, you know, obviously, you know, it's the Oasis podcast. I know you did support Oasis a couple of times. We were sort of messaging before and trying to figure out when it was actually, but yeah, because you know, the band is unbelievably hard to do any research on because of the name, which is great. But yeah, I think we narrowed it down to 2001, Manchester Apollo and Shepherd's Bush Empire on the Noise and Confusion tour. So do you remember how that came about and any memories from that time?
Yeah, lots of memories. In terms of remembering exactly how it came about, it will have been exactly how I just described. Do you know what I mean? Our manager will have rung someone up and gone, come on, let's have my lads on this bill. And someone will have been like, yeah, all right. Do you know what I mean? I'm not privy to how it came about other than that, but I bet my house on the fact that it will, any decent manager will look for appropriate opportunities for a band in an appropriate setting. And at that time, being attached to an Oasis tour, you know, it was a great way of getting a lot of eyes on you. So yeah, I couldn't say exactly who approved it or who asked, but yeah, that was very much the tale of our sort of coming onto the scene. It was full of loads of little exciting things. That it was like a set of stairs that just kept getting more exciting every rung that you went up. Do you know what I mean? And you get a phone call going, right, you're supporting the Charlatans, and you're like, what the fuck? I cannot wait to tell my brother. Do you know what I mean? My brother being a massive Britpop fan of bands like the Charlatans and Oasis and things like that. And then, you know, you get the call saying, oh, you're supporting Oasis. And it was just an absolute whirlwind back in those days. And yeah, I've got vivid memories of both. I can remember the 2 days, everything that happened throughout the day. Do you know, I remember it all vividly, and things leading up to it and after. But yeah, that was an absolute privilege, because I mean, I think I was speaking to you before. I mean, in terms of the things that I used to listen to, I mean, it's not like I didn't listen to Oasis, because you couldn't move on this planet without listening to Oasis at those times. And, you know, both my brothers were heavily, heavily into Oasis and the Britpop scene. And as I've detailed in other podcasts, my dad was a hi-fi nut and still is. And every three kids, and each of us had like a sick hi-fi, because he'd constantly be buying stuff, and he'd be like, well, I bought this now, so you can have this lot in your room. He's like, hey, so I got $5,000 hi-fi in my room. Do you know what I mean? Blasting out all these tunes. So yeah, I was, I grew up listening to all sorts of different stuff from different tastes, my mum's taste, my dad's, and then my two brothers, their different tastes. And yeah, there was a lot of Oasis and stuff being played. And funnily enough, I mean, that was one of the great things about Oasis, I think, which still is, and about their back catalogue. There's something about a band where you can have played guitar for a very little amount of time, and you can pick it up and play an Oasis song. That, sure. I think that's a very powerful thing to have as a band. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know if you're to take a band, just to take a random example out of my head, like Yes, the band Yes, you know, you're not going to be sitting down and playing their songs just on an acoustic guitar around a campfire or in someone's living room when you're having a few joints. Do you know what I mean? And that's where music works its way into. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, you have the nights where everyone gets together in a room and it's a gig, but you have like satellite things where there's 10 lads, you know, having a few joints and drinking a few drinks and just sat in someone's living room with a guitar all bloody singing Supersonic or whatever you want. Do you know what I mean? Any Oasis song. And that had an influence on me as well, in terms of, it's like when I started playing guitar, they were some of the first songs that I learned in terms of just playing through chords were Oasis songs. And I actually think, Do You Know What I Mean was the first single I ever bought. Although there was actually one before that, but that's probably too embarrassing to name. So, but, yeah, in terms of me really starting to connect with music and different aspects of music, Oasis. So while Oasis weren't necessarily something that I sat down to and intently listened to myself, there's no doubt that Oasis had a direct impact on everyone, like everyone. Do you know what I mean? And the pathways that their success laid for other bands and other northern bands and all that sort of stuff, but just the effect they had on culture in general. I'll never make it, I'll 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 make it matter what you think about Oasis, you can't deny when you walk out into one of their gigs and witness what goes on, I'll jump forward in my memories, but after we'd come off stage and got ourselves sorted after the Shepherd's Bush Empire gig, I eventually came out of the dressing room and walked out sort of under the balcony at Shepherd's Bush. I can't remember what song were they playing at the time. I can't really remember because it'd have been the same. It wouldn't really mattered. But I just remember walking out and just being like, fucking hell. Like the sound and the sound of every person in the crowd singing the lyrics back and all that sort of stuff was just an absolute fucking juggernaut. Do you know what I mean? And as someone in a band trying to connect with people, that was something to behold in itself. And, you know, again, no matter what you think about Oasis, you can't deny that it's just genius songwriting and such a great fucking sound. Do you know what I mean? And they were amazing times for this band, really amazing times. I mean, that the Oasis situation in itself was actually a bit bittersweet in some ways. Although the reasons for that will become apparent in the next few minutes. But yeah, I think, well, which bit shall I go into first? I think because there was I don't know how famous it is, but there was the incident with us where we were asked in the NME, you know, so what were it like, you know, having Oasis ask you to support them? And I think Rob turned round and said, well, they should be honoured to have us support them. And I don't think that went down too well. Certainly with Liam, I think Liam called Rob, what did he call him? A fucking little witch or something like that in some interview. But we did ourselves no favours, man. I think, from memory, I think, was it a day of a, so, was it a World Cup game or a qualifier? I don't know what it, you know, it must have been a, I'm sure England were playing Argentina and Rob, not deliberately, wore an Argentina shirt on stage, vintage Argentina shirt. And that really didn't go down well. And as I say, I don't think he did it deliberately. So we walked out at Shepherd's Bush Empire and the reception we got was very strange, really. But I think a lot of that was to do with he was wearing an Argentina shirt on internationals time when we were playing him. And I don't think that went down well. I remember at one point during the set, Rob just sat down cross-legged and looked at me and shook his head. Because we've never struggled to win over an audience. Never. Do you know what I mean? It's always, and that was always something we got off on massively. The fact of, right, no one in this room has ever heard of us. They've never heard us play. But I'll tell you fucking what, like by the time we're finished, they'll never fucking forget us. Do you know what I mean? We experienced that so much, and like the Coldplay tour was probably in America. That were probably the sort of strongest example of that. When you know you had all these through no meaning of judgment, but a relatively pedestrian audience musically, I would say. And then we came out and started playing our stuff, and you know jaws hit the floor, and you could see the people who were just mad into it. And then some people were just like, what the hell is going on here? But yeah, it was, as I say, it was quite bittersweet that first night in Shepherd's Bush. And it was also a bit of a weird day because we were all just crammed into what you call a day room. I mean, obviously when you're touring and especially when you're watching budgets and stuff like that, you have what's called a day room, which is just one hotel room that everyone uses a shower and that and chills out in, just a little bit of a base. So we were in the day room most of the day. I think we were actually in the day room trying to get some bloody weed because we didn't have any, which always made things difficult for us. Do you know what I mean? I think that was just our coping mechanism. We were all so young and we were thrust into these mental situations that would just dwarf most people, and they did us, but sort of just having that time, just a little bit of a joint. And I don't know, it was just a way to deal with that, the anxiety of, oh my God, this is, you know, this is big. I mean, it became normal. But yeah, the Manchester Apollo gig was absolutely amazing. That was brilliant. We got a much better reception And David Beckham was there as well, which was quite funny. I remember all that sort of stuff. But yeah, it was, I don't know. It was a genuine honour to play with Oasis and to witness that firsthand in terms of the effect they have on a crowd and the buzz in the room. I don't know. I think there was a, certainly from my point of view as well, like it back then it was such a strong like lad mentality in terms of it, that whole Oasis thing. And I think that was like, I don't know. And I think that's something that like a mantle that Kasabian kind of picked up and moved on with, because I think us and Kasabian have a lot of parallels in some senses in terms of where we were coming from musically. And you know, Tom and Serge openly talked about when they were really young and came to see us the first time we played Leicester Charlotte, and my brother vividly remembers them at the bar standing there open mouthed watching us. And you know, we had amazing tour with Kasabian and got on with them fantastically. But yeah, I think there was just something about that whole Oasis fan base that didn't quite get us, maybe. Or it was our first taste of, I don't know how you call it, like a really militant fan base. And not necessarily in a bad way, just in a sense of, look, mate, we're here at the Oasis. You lot, fuck off if you want. You know what I mean?
And yeah.
We didn't win over the room in the Shepherd's Bush gig anyway, but it was still part of our journey at that point, where all these ridiculously exciting things were happening.
I know what you mean. It was very much a footballer sort of football, more of a football tribe fan base, and often, you know, a lot of my mates that would go to Oasis gigs, I'd be like, well, you know, we'd be in the pub, and you'd be like, well, come on. You know, we've got to go. And they'd be like, no, I'm not bothered. I'm just getting there to see Oasis. And there was that. Oasis fans were, you know, music fans were Oasis fans, but not all Oasis fans are music fans. Some of them were just Oasis fans, and that was it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, in terms of the lads themselves, I mean, Noel and Liam on the days were absolutely lovely with us. Do you know what I mean? They were absolutely brilliant and came and had conversations with us, and you know, that side of it was fantastic. And it's a little bit of a shame, really, because I think we were caught, like Rob's comments, like, well, they should be honoured to have us. I think the context of these things is something that was lost. And that's you know, that's a journalist's best fucking weapon, that excluding context. Do you know what I mean? Just taking a statement and printing it and being like, look at this. Look what they said. And it's like, well, come on. You can't do that. You've got to give them the rest of the context, and there'll be millions of people throughout the world who are bitter in terms of how one incident was represented by the press or whatever. But yeah, they were absolutely lovely with us. Do you know what I mean? Great lads. And they made time to have a bit of a conversation with us. And as I say, it's not like we fucking felt like they're equals or anything like that. We didn't. Not in the slightest. We were in awe of, just in the same way that we were in awe of the Charlatans. Do you know what I mean? And you know, it's like when we were supporting Charlatans, that were amazing. And then we got a phone call about Oasis. And of course, I was straight on the phone to my fucking brother again, going like, we're supporting Oasis now. It's like, what? And you know, like that never left us. Never left us. And New Order. And then it was like, now we're supporting New Order. And he loved New Order as well. And it was like my time in being in a band was like just a who's who of, yeah, I'm supporting your other favourite band, and now I'm playing with your other favourite band, and yeah, I'm meeting them lads as well. Do you know what I mean? It was just an absolute whirlwind and a privilege. And I don't know, I think there might have been a small element of, well, I mean, as I say, we weren't arrogant. We just knew how fucking good we were. Do you know what I mean? And you know, it's not like we were ever like, oh, we're the best band on the planet and all this sort of shit. It's like we were the best. We were just the best version of ourselves. And I think when we tried to look for a way to qualify that in press articles, it had often come across as missing the mark. You know what I mean? It's like, I've got a funny thing with John Squiremy in a sense that, like, every loads of people, loads of press, loads of interviews, loads of reviews are like, oh, this guitarist must love John Squire. And then they come and speak to you and they're like, so John Squire's your favorite guitarist? And I'm like, no, don't even listen to, don't even listen to Stone Roses. And in one of my rants, I said John Squire's shit. Which I didn't mean in the blunt way that it came out, but of course the NME just printed a big headline saying Adam Nutter says John Squire is shit, which led to Manny coming up to me at one gig and saying you've got a fucking long way to go before you're as good as him and shit like that. And it's like, oh, fucking, I don't need this crap. All I meant by that was in the same way that I've just detailed to you how Oasis were something that I was affected by, but not necessarily part of my lighting candles sitting in my room with my sick hi-fi and listening to an entire album, probably because I could walk around the house and it'd be blasting out upstairs, so I'd already have heard it anyway. But it was the same deal with the Stone Roses. Like, my brother was massively into the Stone Roses, but I, you know, it was at that time I was much more into stuff like Smashing Pumpkins and Radiohead and Mogwai and even fucking Sigur Rós, do you know what I mean? I was listening to Sigur Rós since I was about 15, 16 or something like that. They were the things that were speaking to me more. And like, I don't know, I could just never understand that link. And sometimes when you're in your own little bubble and you get exasperated about me, because it was just being misrepresented. It wasn't like a case of, I don't want to be attached to that idea, because I've got no problem with the Stone Roses. Great fucking band. Again, massively influential band, culturally significant, influential, iconic, all these sorts of things. It was just like, yeah, but please don't misrepresent my attachment to that, because you're presuming and assuming, I'm not sure based on what, that I'm some massive John Squire fan. And like, not being funny, but sat here now, do you know what I mean? It's like James Dean Bradfield at that point in time was more something that was influencing me, you know. Sure. the Holy Bible was on repeat for me.
It's just lazy, isn't it? It's like, okay, well, it's a northern four piece. They've got like a dance beat and long hair and sort of cool, funky kind of, you know, Led Zeppy and sort of bluesy, but also kind of soundscapes. And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, it's just a lazy, obvious comparison, but
exactly. But
yeah. Well, that's
it's exactly a fair point. And you've hit the nail on the head, really. It's like, well, go a little bit before that, because I'll argue that I'm influenced by Jimmy Page, and I'd also argue that John Squire is influenced by Jimmy Page. So maybe my link to that you're hearing is through something else. And I agree completely what you're saying in terms of lazy, presumptuous journalism, because, you know, journalists are people too. Do you know what I mean? they're not always, people make mistakes and people don't always get things right, but it's very easy to alienate artists and creative people. And again, not that I've ever had the airs and graces to be like, oh, well, you can't disrespect me and all that shit, but no one likes being misunderstood, do you know what I mean? And as I said earlier, I always found it difficult thinking, well, you know, we're being misrepresented here. And I still get it now, people messaging me going, so like, John Squire's your favorite guitarist? And it's like, oh mate, Lindsey Buckingham from Fleetwood Mac's my favorite guitarist. Like, that's pinnacle of guitar playing, in my opinion. Do you know what I mean? And everything else is fine. Yeah, don't get me wrong. But if someone asked for my guitar heroes, it would be Lindsey Buckingham, and then things like Nick McCabe. But that came a little bit later for me. appreciation of things like that. Because, you know, the Verve, I do love the Verve. Do you know what I mean? And the Verve for me were something that I would sit down and listen to myself. Do you know what I mean? When things like maybe Oasis and Stone Roses were things that were part of my life and part of things that I was hearing, but not necessarily something, you know, like I used to have a mini disc player and I used to be constantly putting things on my mini disc and, you know, it would be the Verve and early U2 and Sigur Rós and Mogwai and, you know, later, moving a bit later, things like the Smiths, you know what I mean? I absolutely adore the Smiths. And they were more sort of the Manchester side that I would attach myself to be honest. And Johnny Marr's guitar playing being massively, massively unique, massively melodic. And yeah, and I don't know, I sometimes struggle talking about these things because I feel with one sentence you could completely alienate yourself from hundreds of thousands of people by sort of turning around and going, oh, I don't listen to Oasis, which, as I say, that's not representing how I feel about Oasis properly. Do you know what I mean? I've tried to give you the context of, like, these things were omnipresent, Oasis and Stone Roses. So I was kind of seeking out things that were less omnipresent at that time. Do you know what I mean? Like, later Smashing Pumpkins records and stuff like that, you know. I don't know, it's musical taste and musical influence is a very gray area, and it's very hard to put your finger on a lot of the time.
I know what you mean. I think Oasis either speak to you or they don't, and I suppose when you've got, I think there's a couple of aspects. You've got the fact that a lot of sort of snobby people who like, oh, I just won't listen to them because of the fact that they're northern dickheads. And then but then you get like, I get that a bit. It's like, you do an Oasis podcast? Oasis, really? And you know, or then you get the more like that, you know, like for me, what I love about them is that the songs, the passion in the songs, and the songs are all I and we, and you know, it's all you and I, and that sort of thing, and that, the way that really speaks to me. Whereas I completely understand it, and a lot of musicians that don't necessarily feel that way, because it's more like, well, you know, what just floats my boat is more Sigur Rós's soundscapes, you know what I mean? Or it is more this intricate, Morrissey's intricate wordplay. And Oasis don't do that, you know, they never have, then that's just not. So no, I completely get it. And I think most people accept that. It's just like, if they speak to you, then they really speak to you, and they're your favorite band, you know. And then you've got the people that it's like, you know, well, yeah, they like them because they like bloody Take That and Oasis, you know, because they both did big songs with choruses, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, it's good fun. I mean, talking about Sigur Rós, actually, I mean, you know, I don't know if people are aware of your solo stuff. Obviously, you've got an album coming, and you've teased a few tracks already on YouTube and things. But yeah, a lot different from what I've heard of it so far. Anyway, different from that sort of Four to the Floor music style. It is, I thought Sigur Rós, actually, those sort of soundscapes and a bit more ethereal and so that's been fantastic. How's that sort of come about?
Well, that came about really as a result of it's probably a story I've told in different guises a few times, but as I say, when the music split up, I found it also painful that, well, I mean, I say I elected to take myself away from everything. It didn't really feel like I had a choice. I mean, it's been pointed out to me since that it was like a self-imposed exile, but I'm not quite sure that's true, to be honest. Do you know what I mean? It was a case of, I found it so traumatic, the music ending, that I didn't know what to do with the rest of my life. And I went in search of trying to become a normal person doing normal stuff, all the while living with this stuff in my memory. And I built new circles of friends who had no idea I'd been in a band, because I just didn't talk about it, because I found it impossible to represent. You know, when I started working in my mate's vape shop, selling e-cigarettes and stuff, and no one had a clue. You know, you in there, if you start talking about that, and you're like, oh yeah, we're in a really big band. It's like, well, why are you working in a fucking vape shop then, dickhead? Do you know what I mean? It's like, no, you don't get it. Do you know what I mean? And in the years since, I've been doing gardening with my mate who runs his own gardening business, and same deal. I mean, he knew all about it because his sister actually married our drummer. But I used to avoid telling people that I was ever in a band because A, I found it too painful to talk about and it brought back too many memories. And B, I could just never make people understand because, again, they'd be like, well, why are you gardening? Why are you gardening as someone's assistant then? It's like, well, because I'm trying to find something I can fucking do in my life, because I left school with, you know, this being my primary focus and not having many qualifications. Well, I mean, I've got my GCSEs, don't get me wrong, but like, I wasn't equipped to deal with the normal things in life. But anyway, so when Tim Burgess arranged a listening party for our first album, and I joined Twitter and was given the opportunity to not only connect with all these people who love the music, but reconnect with my bandmates, because we hadn't spoken for a decade either. Do you know what I mean? We just went our separate ways. So basically, when I reconnected with it all, started talking to all these people, got loads of fans on Twitter, it just kind of suddenly occurred to me that I had like a platform to do what I loved again, or like try. And there was a lot of me that was like, well, you know, can I do this? Because it's going to cost me a lot of money to buy all the things I need to be able to start recording music again, because I just didn't have any of it. And I didn't play guitar for a decade.
Really?
Do you know, I literally didn't play guitar for a decade and started gardening and destroying my hands and stuff. although funnily enough, the beautiful thing about that was when the reunion show got discussed as a possibility, I was suddenly like, oh shit, I best pick up a guitar, like terrified, thinking that the bone structure would have changed in my hand through gardening and doing all this sort of repetitive strain and working with power tools and that. So I fucking picked up a guitar and I was better than I ever have been. Straight away.
That's the strength, yeah.
Well, yeah, exactly. And that's what I thought. I thought, bloody hell, I wonder if that's from all the gardening and stuff, just making my hands stronger and muscles and tendons. I don't know, but I found it easy, and I just like went on a massive journey of inspiration again. And it was like not breathing for 10 years, not creating any music or being creative. And yeah, I was creative in a sense of, you know, I'd cut people's shrubs in the garden and make them look fucking mint. And that's where I found my joy. Yeah. For a long time, I was like, look at that. No one would cut that fucking laurel bush better than me. That is laser sharp. But, you know, I got that. Customers would come out and be like, oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
You're like, well, that's where I got my joy. But suddenly I was like, wow, I'm playing guitar. I'm making sounds. And funnily enough, Dream Twister was the first thing I did when I picked up a guitar again. My fingers just literally fucking played it, and I remember thinking, wow, this sounds really good, I'm gonna get my phone out and record it. And that was something I'm very pleased that I did, because in my experience, you know, ideas like that often disappear like smoke from a fire. Do you know what I mean? And if you don't record it then and there, the subtle nuances that make it good, the little rhythmic shifts and whatever, they can be lost, and you're like, well, why doesn't that sound as good as it did the first time I played it? But if you record it, then, you know, you've got it as record. And anyway, I woke up because when the band split up, I did have a big surge of, right, I'm going to do this myself then. I'm going to make my own music. And I did about 15 demos. And I remember vividly just one morning waking up and just being like, I can't do this. I can't do this anymore. It's too painful. It's too stressful, thinking, is this good enough? Is this going to give me a career pathway? Because at that point, as much as anything, it was like, well, the band had ended and so had my primary income stream, without being too blunt about it. And it's like, well, how am I going to earn money for the rest of my life? you know, most people peak career-wise a lot later, not fucking 27 when we packed in. Mm. And suddenly at 27, I'm left there going, well, it's not just me, the rest of the lads too, but, you know, they've gone on their own journeys and I can only talk about my own. But all of a sudden you're like, what the fuck am I going to do with my life? And so just as I woke up that morning years and years ago and went, fuck this, I can't do this anymore, I'm just going to go try and live a normal life. The same thing happened in reverse once I picked up guitar and started reading all these messages from the people who were like, you're one of the best guitar players in the world and shit. And first of all, you're like, well, that's bollocks, but thank you very much. Do you know what I mean? It's like that respect and that love just like, you know, raised me up without, again, without being too cliche, but that's made me bigger than the sum of my parts. And I just remember thinking, I want to make a fucking record, man. And I want to make something that's a bit different. And, you know, and I am getting more confident with my voice now, but certainly back when I made that record, I wasn't confident in my voice. And I was just like, well, I'm going to make an instrumental record. Mm-hmm. And it was actually, I started a Patreon, do you know what I mean? And I do weekly live streams and obviously my podcast. And then I put my demos out to my patrons. But it was actually one of my patrons during one of my live streams where I was just jamming, who were like, you should really make an instrumental album. And it was like a light bulb went off in my head. And I was just like, yeah, I should. And I'd invested the little money I had left that I'd been guarding, honestly, guarding that for like 10 years. And I never knew why I was guarding it. But it's weird how fate works out. Because it's like, well, I've got exactly enough money to be able to just buy a laptop and these couple of things that I need to start making music. And yeah, it just went from there, really. It was just through like a rebirth of falling back in love with music, falling back in love with the memories of the music, and being able to talk to all these people and share my memories with people. Just it rebuilt me as a person in so many ways. And this record is a culmination of that, very much so. It's a culmination of years of frustration. And that's what it is, Badlands on Fire. It's like coming out of a horrible place and turning round before you close the door and throwing a fucking match on the floor with a load of petrol and going, yeah, fucking burn, and I'm going to stand and watch you burn. You know what I mean? Just for the satisfaction of knowing that that place has been burned to the ground, that place where I was. And it's like moving out of that into into a much more, back into what I was born to do and feeling the feelings that I felt when I was young, that, you know, waking up and not being like, oh, fucking hell, it's another day of being alive. Brilliant. Mm. More like it's another day of opportunities to create sounds and shit that make you go, wow, man, that's fucking that makes me feel amazing. And that's what Badlands on Fire is. It's a collection of instrumental pieces that really tell, you know, like an instrumental story through it's pure emotion, that record. Every single track is just pure emotion and different aspects of the journey that I've been on in terms of rediscovering myself, rediscovering my love of music, and rediscovering a proper purpose that made me feel like I had a place. Because that, as I say, that was one of the hardest things about losing the band, was it ripped my identity from me. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, ever since I found this, I've needed it, because like, I've always felt that I never really fit in anywhere. Do you know what I mean? Or with anyone, never fit in anywhere or with anyone. But the second I started playing guitar and knocking out riffs and playing with them lads, it was like, this is where I belong. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. This is what, it's Adam Nutter, the guitarist in the music. Do you know what I mean?
That is you.
Yeah, that was something that gave me a platform in my own mind and helped me look at myself and feel any sense of pride. Whereas I'm a bit of a self-loathing person. And I know there's lots of us out there who struggle to love ourselves. And yeah, it was difficult losing all that. So it's just a pure joy and celebration of rediscovering all that, really. That's what that record is. And obviously produced by the amazing James Chapman, and that in itself is magical, because on the off chance I just put out a tweet saying, look, does anyone fancy making like an atmospheric cinematic ambient record with me, like, and I put Dream Twister, the YouTube, you know, just a version of me playing it in me bloody house, and James Chapman, Maps came back and were just like, yeah, I'll fucking do that. And I was like, wow, man, like a legitimate sort of Mercury nominated artist wanting to work with me. That was just another brick in the wall of, wow, I've really been like, I've really not seen myself in the right light for a very long time. But yeah, and I can't thank James Chapman enough, really, for the amazing process that me and him both went through creating this album, because there was nothing hard about it, nothing difficult. It was just pure joy, incredibly easy. Everything just fell into place. And, you know, we were finishing stuff off and James were bouncing it back to me saying, right, okay, any notes, just let me know. And I just be like, I ain't got any fucking notes, mate. Other than that, it's absolutely mind-blowing. And he's like, what, no notes at all? I'm like, no, it's fucking perfect. I can make up some fucking notes if you want something to do. But for the most part, mate, that is perfect. It's fucking perfect.
That's fantastic. No, that's great to know. Taking it to a sort of a place of Oasis, like as I often just try and, that's how I kind of view the world. It was like when Oasis split, then Liam like just kept going with BDI, and BDI never did what it needed. You know, it just couldn't do it, both in the quality they put out and then what the acceptance from the fans, and they needed to go away, you know, and that's the thing. It's like that, you know, how can you miss me if I don't go away? And it was like, I completely understand where you're coming from. If you're like, you've been in this thing, it's defined you and you're going to try and carry it on, but it's obviously going to be a lesser version because it's not this thing that was the four of you that was this beast. And so if you're going to do it yourself, oh, hold on a minute. But yeah, actually having that break of it and having just lived that different life and gone back to, you know, and almost having to step away from it, but then going back into it. And I can imagine, what a cathartic and magic experience that must be.
Absolutely. And, you know, it was an absolute joy, privilege, and an honour to be able to do the Temple News and Reunion show that we did and get to step back into those shoes and remember it. And I remember the irony of thinking, fucking hell, do you know what I mean? We were quite a big band and we have to disappear for 10 years and then come back to be able to play like to fucking 12,000 people at Temple News, which was such an important place to us all anyway, because it's so close to where we live. It was just like an absolute dream, really. But It did have with it a twinge of, well, it's a bit cruel at the same time, because it's like, you're gonna give me this taste of what was without any potential going forward. That's just another thing that we're like, well, I'm going to do my own thing. I don't have to conquer the fucking world. Do you know what I mean? I just have to feel like I've got my own space, my own little niche, and my own set of people who appreciate what I do. And that's why I had no qualms about releasing an instrumental album. And I know it's that in itself is a niche thing. And some people are like, oh, I just don't listen to instrumental music. And it's like, well, fair enough, whatever. I've never differentiated between that. You know, I can sit there and watch Last of the Mohicans and be fucking blown away by the soundtrack and the music in Last of the Mohicans in the same way that I can sit down and listen to Siamese Dream and be absolutely blown away by the sheer fucking amazing quality of those songs, guitar playing, drumming, bass playing, singing, everything. I don't see a difference. I don't. In the same way that I sit down and listen to Chopin or something like that, or Shostakovich, or I don't see a fucking difference. Vibrations in the air are as such, and the platform they are on is totally irrelevant to me. So I don't understand. Oh, I don't listen to instrumental music. It's like, well, you're missing out on a lot.
You're missing out on a huge swathe of the history of recorded music. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was excited about making something a little bit different. And that's why I wanted to work with an artist. And that's why, you know, we've done a canvas for each piece of music. And it's just been a real, as you said, a real cathartic experience where it's like, it's not focused on, oh my God, I've got to sell millions of these to make a living. It's nothing to do with that. It's more just this is me expressing some joy in the medium of music, and you know, just beautiful melodies and thought provoking shit that you can get lost in. That's what I love.
No, absolutely. And just to flag up, you know, like you mentioned there, you're a patron. So it's not via Patreon, which is, you know, what I use and a lot of YouTubers and things use. It's the Podbean, the specific to the podcast, isn't it? And
that's right.
Yeah, and I know from there, like you said about, you know, these demos. So I know that, you know, my friend Richard, who's been on the podcast and works for Live Forever, I think he's booked you in. I know he's been a patron for a long time and loved getting hold of those demos and things like that. It's such a, that's the thing. I can't believe more musicians haven't gone down this route, because podcasters and YouTubers and stuff have been doing it for years. And I know Embrace did it. I interviewed Steve from Embrace, and it was like, why the hell wouldn't you do that? You know, it just like, you've got this ability of all this stuff that's out there that people were desperate to hear, and you can give it to them. It doesn't have to be this whole record company design thing with a release schedule and all that crap. Just so if someone's happy to pay £5, £10 a month, they can get this unheard stuff that only a handful of other people are going to hear. And it's magic, and it's special, and you feel you're part of something, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. And we've got a community in ourselves, and you know, we do weekly live streams and everyone comes in the chat and we have a laugh and I play stuff. It's, as you say, it's not actually on Patreon. It's a patron system direct through Podbean, which is my podcast platform, and you join it via there. And there are different tiers and that, and you get different rewards on different. It's quite simple, really. It's multifaceted, really, in that it's people paying to support the podcast in itself, because the more time I'm able to put into this stuff, the more I can do. But if I'm sort of going out gardening a lot and doing that sort of stuff, I obviously don't have the same amount of time. So it kind of supports the podcast in itself, but it also, the money enables me to do the things that I've done in terms of making an album with James Chapman producing and getting my own vinyl manufactured, because all this is self-funded. It's all through my own record label. And it's me that's dealing with all these companies, getting the CDs made, getting the vinyls made, getting the T-shirts, the prints, the books. It's like, that's all done by me and Ross and Nicola McCulley, who are a husband and wife design team, who have helped me absolutely no end. I couldn't have done it without them. But yeah, it, as you say, it's a great way of connecting with fans. And variety and frequency of content does fluctuate a little bit, but the people who are part of it, they understand that. You know what I mean? One month I might put out 3 songs, and then I might go 3 months where I haven't put out any song demos, but I'll have been doing regular podcasts and I'll have been doing my live streams where I play guitar a lot and, you know, I play obscure the music stuff and all that sort of stuff. Do you know what I mean? So it's a very organic thing, and it has a huge element of freedom. I mean, it does have its own anxieties attached to it, because I do get in more, because I am bipolar, and I do get on what I refer to as the bipolar helter skelter. Do you know what I mean? Where sometimes suddenly you've just fucking fired down a rabbit hole and you might be down there for longer than you'd like. And some people would be like, well, you haven't put out a song this month, so I'm canceling or whatever. But it's free and easy, and people are perfectly willing to do that. But then I'll come out of it and put out some quality song demos. And I think it's just turned, people just love supporting me. The people that do, I think they just love the idea that they're giving me an opportunity to explore my creativity, and then they get to hear the fruits of it and stuff. And it's the same with the podcast. Like, the podcast frequency has dipped a little bit. I mean, I'm up to 82 episodes, and the majority of those were week after week after week after week, whereas this year I think I've only done 3 so far, which doesn't sit entirely well with me, and I do beat myself up about things like that. But again, the patrons are like, look, mate, you've given us so much. Don't worry. You don't have to do one every week. Do you know what I mean? Do them when you feel right and ready. But yeah, it's incredibly liberating to have the direct support from people that doesn't rely on things like you point out, record labels and all that sort of stuff. Do you know what I mean? It's And they're the ones who have enabled me to make the products that I'm making and design the things that I've, you know, if I didn't have Patreon, I'd be out gardening to earn money. If I'm out gardening, I'm not going to be recording and writing and podcasting as much, really. So, yeah, it's and it took me a lot of time to be comfortable with the idea that people might want to do that. But Pete Fletcher, who I do the podcast with, he's responsible for a lot of poking and prodding. Do you know what I mean? In terms of, no, come on, set it up. I'm telling you, set it up. People don't want to, they won't, and you've got nothing to lose. But just see what happens. And, you know, I set it up and I got loads straight away, and it, you know, all things that massively built my confidence and made me feel great about what I were doing. And I love giving them content. I love doing the live streams. And yeah, I'm real, man. Do you know what I mean? So like sometimes I'll do a live stream and I won't be in the best of moods, and they'll get a very different side of me. But you know, we can have streams that are an absolute riot, and where I've had a few drinks and they're hilarious, and I tell funny stories. And then there'll be times where for an hour and a half I drone on about how fucking depressed I am and shit like that. But I don't know, man. It's like direct access into my brain a lot of the times, which can be a slightly tumultuous place. But yeah, it's really given me a new lease of life. Really has.
Oh, well, that's brilliant. So there you go. If people want to support Adam and be part of that community, then yeah, absolutely. I'll put a link in the description to this. But yeah, Podbean, and it's easy enough. It's easy enough to find. I literally found it in two clicks. So no, but that's brilliant. So yeah, so new albums, hopefully coming out in the next sort of couple of months.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've got the a show as well, Hyde Park Book Club in Leeds, which I mean, I'm really looking forward to, and then at the same time, I'm really anxious about, because I like to get things right, man. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I'm not one of these people who just rolls on stage and like, oh shit, what am I doing? I'm a perfectionist, so a lot of work is going into making that show great, but it's getting there now. Really excited about it, and yeah, that's just about sold out, I think. Although there is the possibility we might be moving that to a bigger venue. Oh, so there might be some more tickets available for that soon. But I can keep you updated on that. And, you know, watch this space for any news, updates on the show and stuff like that. But, yeah, it's going to be an exciting time for me seeing stuff come to fruition, yeah.
And you know who's a really good kind of example? I don't know if you follow Andy Bell's career at all, but he does his Andy Bell solo albums, but then he's also got the Glock solo project, which is electronic music. And then he's been doing these Andy Bell soundstation gigs where he'll just turn up and it is kind of, you know, it's just him with a guitar. And so he's not, you know, when he does Ride, he's obviously doing these massive arenas. So it's much smaller venues, but it's just like, he loves it. And this is his, you know, and it doesn't matter if he's playing to a few hundred or whatever, because that's how he wants to do it for that part. It's like he's compartmentalized his life into he can do Ride, and then he can go off and do Glock Andy Bell soundstation. And I think that's a really nice kind of you know, sort of example of someone like yourself that you've got that as sort of something to follow.
Absolutely, and it was my brother again, actually, through all this, who said, look what Andy Bell's doing, and exactly the same as you said, like, he's just turning up with a guitar and playing to a few hundred people, and he's loving it, and so, do you know what I mean, like, because I was just like, well, who's going to want to come and see me play an instrumental stuff, do you know what I mean, but like you say, like, well, Andy Bell's doing it, and he loves it, and just that's little things like that, like you say, just legitimize and make you feel better about the steps that you're taking, yeah.
Brilliant. All right. Well, look, Adam, it's been absolutely fascinating today. I've really, really appreciated the time and talking to you. It's great fun. But yeah, so as I said, if I'll put links in the description there, people can find your how to pre-order the album and check you out on the Podbean. But yeah, thanks so much.
No problem. Thank you very much for having me on. Like I say, any excuse to talk about all this stuff is brilliant. So yeah, I appreciate it immensely.
All right. All the best. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Wow, I hope you guys enjoyed that. What a fantastic talker Adam is. You can tell he's obviously his podcast is fantastic because he's just, you know, willing to tell stories and be honest and be brutally honest, talking about his own sort of mental health and things like that, which I just think is really, really brilliant. And yeah, so impressed by him and really a pleasure to deal with. Great guy. So yeah, definitely check him out, support him if you can, and let him know the Oasis podcast sent you. All right, that'll do it for today. Thank you very much for listening, and most of all, thanks go to our patrons. You put your money where your mouth is, and it's greatly appreciated. You can go to patreon.com/oasispod, which is where we post bonus episodes, episodes early, articles, various other things go on over there. You can also become part of our Discord community by going to Patreon and asking for a link, and we'll let you in. That's really cool. That tends to be where we sort of have the regular day-to-day sort of chat going on, which has been brilliant. And also on there, you can sort of really, that's the best place if you're going to be involved in an episode to kind of put yourself forward. Yeah, if people are willing to support me financially, then I'm more willing to sort of, if I need someone to come on an episode, then I'll go to the patrons first, and I'll tend to go to the people on Discord because they're the ones I interact with the most. And the next upcoming sort of Patreon one, we've just recorded it, is the 1980s chat, best song of the year. You know, we've done the 2000s, we've done the 90s, and now we've done the 80s, and that was with Amy and Matt and Imran Khan, might say. So yeah, so hope you guys enjoy that. Right, that'll do it. As ever, stay in touch, stay engaged, and stay young.